Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Arya Irani, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu to get more information. The title of today's forum is A Reporter's Perspective of the Utah State Legislature. Today's guest is Paul Rowley. Paul Rowley was a Salt Lake City native. He graduated from the U in political science and had a minor in journalism. He started at the Salt Lake Tribune as a copy boy and worked there for 40 years. He was a business editor, an assistant city editor, and a legislative and political reporter. He spent 3 years at UPI as a state political reporter and was a Salt Lake City bureau chief. He started The Column in 1991 with Joanne Wells, who she retired in 2004. He is a former president of the Utah chapter of the Society of the Professional Journalism. So please welcome me in joining our guest today.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay? First of all, I just want to say I'm glad to be here at the Hinckley Institute. I love this place. When I was a student here at the U back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, I didn't miss, I came every forum, every coffee and politics, every event they had at the here at the Hinckley Institute, I would come. I will admit that I even skipped a couple of classes sometimes to come over here to hear government leaders and politicians, and I soaked it up, and it was a really important part of my education, I believe, at the U. And a lot of the stuff that I absorbed coming here to the Hinckley Institute helped me later on as I developed into a political journalist at the Salt Lake Tribune. With that said, I've done before and talked to your professor about, we're going to spend most of the time taking questions from you, and he assures me that you're all prepared for that. I'll spend a few minutes just kind of setting the groundwork for what's going on now, the environment at the legislature. There's just about a week and a half left in this session. This is the most Republican legislature in Utah since 1985. There are only 14 Democrats in a 75-member House, 5 Democrats in a 24-member Senate. So basically, for all intents and purposes, there's two political parties in Utah, the conservative Republican Party and the moderate Republican Party. And even the moderate Republican Party keeps, having to get more and more conservative to survive. This session has been a little more subdued than last year's session. Last year's session, I mean, we've had our share of, interesting bills and message bills and things like that, but it was nothing like last year's session. The reason for that was there were several legislators who were elected, 2008, 2010. A lot came in the Tea Party Revolution of 2010, who came in with a whole new agenda. Anti-federal government, a lot of factors played into that. The TARP bailout, the national debt that we had gotten into, and it allowed for some really anti-government rhetoric to get into the mainstream of politics, and so for several years that kind of dominated the political debate, and Utah was no exception. This may be come from as an opinion, but I think it's an informed opinion. It allowed for what that did is it created an opening for people who I believe who weren't really ready to be good legislators, weren't really qualified, weren't that knowledgeable on what you need to know to get elected based on just this, you know, rhetoric, inflammatory rhetoric. And a lot of people got elected on that, and a lot of these guys had real big ambitions and saw themselves as, you know, congressmen, governors. And they formed what was called the Patrick Henry Caucus. And I made a lot of fun of that, by the way, in my column over the years. It was basically nothing but slogans. I never thought they had a lot of depth, a lot of substance. But they got a lot of traction, and they had an impact, you know, at the legislature, because it was not popular for a while to go against that rhetoric. It made you, you know, a socialist or a liberal or whatever. Even the Republicans, you know, responsible Republicans were a little hesitant to challenge a lot of that. But what happened was all those guys, after they were in the legislature for a little while, ran for higher office. And they challenged our current governor, Gary Herbert. They challenged, Hatch. No, the guy who challenged Hatch, I wouldn't put him in that category. He was actually a very bright, very competent guy. Dan Lilliquist, and they ran for Congress, and they all lost in the Republican primary, and so now they're all gone. And after the 2010 session, after Bob Bennett got defeated, I think there was a lot of buyer's remorse when he got defeated, and he was everybody knows who Bob Bennett is, right? That longtime U.S. Senator, Republican, conservative, very well respected. And all of a sudden, when he got bounced in the convention, and then we got a Tea Party guy to replace him, I think there was a lot of buyer's remorse in the Republican Party, and they started thinking about, you know, what are we doing? Orrin Hatch saw what happened to Bennett in 2010, and what had happened to him was basically the Tea Party people took over the the caucuses in March, the neighborhood caucuses where delegates to the convention are elected. And I knew the night of the caucuses, or the next morning after I called around all my sources to see what happened, that Bennett was going to lose in the convention, because it happened that night in the caucus, because they stacked the caucuses. Hatch saw that and was not going to let that happen to him. And he started his campaign in 2010 for 2012 as a groundswell campaign to make sure that he had his people at as many neighborhood caucuses as possible so he wouldn't be defeated. Another thing happened between 2010 and 2012, and that was the LDS Church actually became a little alarmed at some of the rhetoric that started coming out of from the conventions and the candidates that came out as a result of that, and there were very strong statements made in 2012 from the ward pulpits. There was a letter sent out that every bishop read in the ward that not only said participate, but said go to your neighborhood caucuses, get involved. And that was because they wanted it to be a more mainstream representation, which it was. And they call it the Hatch Effect in 2012. And what the Hatch Effect was, was because he worked very hard to counter the Tea Party revolution in the caucuses. The result was a much more moderate base of Republican delegates who went to the convention, and not only got him out of the convention, but nominated a much more moderate group of legislative candidates than they'd had before. This last year, about a good dozen very conservative Tea Party type Republicans were defeated by more moderate Republicans, and now there's a big organization, Prosperity 2020, that is founded by, you know, Republican stalwarts in the state of Utah, Norm Banger, Olene Walker, Nolan Karras, Lane Beatty, and their whole push is education, and so now you've got a battle between that base, you know, group, establishment Republican group, and the more right wing or Tea Party conservative Republican group who kind of have a disdain for public education and keep doing things more and more to push towards private contractors to provide education software and they're doing all sorts of things, and you're seeing that a lot this year of pushing the education model away from the traditional education bureaucracy in Utah and putting it more in the hands of private contractors who develop online software and that sort of thing. And you've got a few very powerful people, mostly in the Senate, who are pushing the agenda in that direction. And so that's a battle that's actually going on in the Republican Party. Most of the battles right now for the future of Utah are happening within the Republican Party, because the Democrats, quite frankly, are pretty irrelevant at this point. And there's some, there are several reasons for that. One of them, not the least, is the gerrymandering that's taken place over the last couple of decades, where the legislative boundaries have been drawn to very much favor Republicans, and sometimes they'll even draw boundaries to put two incumbent Democrats in the same district together, so one will have to lose, and so that's been a factor. But like I say, even though this legislature has been is the most Republican we've seen in a long time, it's more moderate and I would say a better legislature than what we had last year and the year before. With that kind of groundwork and introduction, I'm going to let you ask me questions now. I think that's what you're supposed to do, your assignment. So I'll open it up. If there's a lull in the questions, I can talk about some other things. But I'm going to turn this over to you now and let you ask me anything you want about the political landscape, the legislature, agenda or the priorities are, or anything you want to ask me.
So, yeah, we're going to questions. Just a reminder, say a little about yourself. Speak clearly in the microphone.
My name's Rochelle Roberts, and I'm a senior here at the U. And I was just, I guess, curious how you feel about the education issue. Do you think it's positive for it to go in a more privatized manner, or do you think just the benefits or the detriments of what's happening right now?
Well, there's a real argument for pushing the ball forward to more technology in education, more online products that students can choose from, and that sort of thing. But the fear is when you start contracting these things out, you know, one of the argument I would lean toward is let the state, the professionals in state, the state education system, state office of education, who are governed by an elected state board of education. Let them, they're moving in that direction themselves and doing the best they can with very little money, by the way. One of the reasons why, we don't have computers in every classroom like a lot of other states do is the funding issue. And that's been a real issue for several years. And there are certain senators who want to privatize that, and they think that the private and it's it's an honest opinion. I mean, they come by this honestly, but their philosophy is that the private sector does it better, and so there's a real push to contract out all sorts of different online learning programs and that sort of thing. There's the fear is that when you start doing that and start making it into a profit-making type enterprise, that the profit motive may get in the way of the maybe the priority rather than what's good for the students. Senator Howard Stevenson, used his power to force the State Board of Education a few years ago to give a contract, and it was an online program to measure the performance of different teachers and classrooms in schools, and it was given to and he totally believed in this company called Digital Bridge that was kind of a new company and was in this area. And even though in the first bidding process, they weren't even in the top three, Senator Stevenson went back and put a lot of pressure on the board, and they opened up the bidding again, finally gave the contract to this Digital Bridge. And the State Office of Education spent $5 million on this contract. Digital Bridge then went bankrupt, went out of business, and never did deliver on the product. So those are the fears about where we're going, but there is a very strong element right now in the legislature, particularly in the Senate, that believes very strongly in moving this more and more into the private sector.
My name is Carter Folger. I'm a student of political science here at the U. You talked about the Tea Party a lot, and you said that in 2010 there was this revolution, if you will, or the Tea Partiers kind of came in and took over the Republican Party. Do you see it more of a shift towards the moderate for the Utah Republicans? I know that the Democrats are a super minority right now, but for the Republicans, are you seeing it more of a shift towards the center? Or
I'm seeing a pushback. And when you say the center, I mean, Utah is a very conservative state. And when I talk about moderate Republicans, they're conservatives. Bob Bennett was a conservative, a very well-respected conservative senator from Utah. But he was very good at reaching across the aisle and trying to find compromises with Democrats. And what happened with the Tea Party movement is the Tea Party movement was based on a certain ideology. And if you veered from that ideology, then you weren't pure. You weren't a good representative or a good senator. And just the fact that he would work with Democrats, he co-sponsored a bill with a senator from Oregon named Ron Wyden and it was a health care bill, and it was an alternative to Obamacare, and it was a private industry-based, bill, and it was a conservative alternative, a Republican, if you will, alternative to Obamacare, and he got pilloried for that in Utah because he was working with a Democrat, and it was that sort of thing that was going on in 2010 that resulted in certain people now in Congress and in the Senate and in the legislature who are unbending, and that's why nothing can get done now in Congress, because you have to stick to the ideology, you have to stick to the principle, and the whole idea of the great two parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, trying to, you know, recognizing their basic core differences philosophically, but working together for solutions is gone. But there is a pushback now, and I'm seeing it in Utah. And like I said in my opening remarks, this legislature, it's a very conservative legislature, don't get me wrong. But it's a conservative legislature with reason, based on reason, I believe, that we didn't see for the last two or three years, at least as far as the rhetoric goes. I hope that answered your question. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Dallin Johnson. I'm studying economics here at the U. My question for you is, how substantial and influential do you feel your role as a political journalist, like how substantial do you think that is on politics and the political process in the state of Utah?
Well, that's a good question, I can answer it. I'm not sure my answer is going to be accurate. It might be based on my own, you know, my own little catbird seat from where my point of view. But I feel that we do make a difference, the press, and I do believe that I know that they the politicians read us, and they pay attention. Usually they'll they'll be angry, or they'll push back, or they'll say, in fact, some of them have started their own media. Now everybody's got a blog. And so you'll see blogs all the time from legislators and stuff saying how the media got it wrong. But they do pay attention, and I do believe that the press does make a difference. I think that the press plays a vital role in this whole scheme, the whole constitutional scheme of our government. That's all based on checks and balances, and I believe the press does provide a certain amount of check, people will read our stories and our columns, and they will react, and the legislature will hear from them. The best example I think is 2 years ago. When the legislature was it 2 years ago or last year when the legislature passed HB 477, which was the bill that basically gutted the Public Records Act, which was called GRAMA, the Government Records Access and Management Act, the press, we covered that very extensively, and we had editorials, we had stories, and the legislature just pushed that through very quickly, just near the last days of the session, without any debate. And it went to the governor, and then he signed it. And because of the press coverage, because nobody really knew what was going on when that bill passed, and when that happens, you always know that there's something wrong with a piece of legislation when it's kind of hurried through in caucuses and then pushed onto the floor and then passed like that without any debate. You always know there's a reason why they don't want any public attention. There was so much press coverage on that they got so much heat from their own constituents. They thought that it would just be the media that would, that would carp about it for a while and then it would go away. But they had no idea that the reaction they would get from their own constituents and their own base. And so they called the bill back and repealed it. And that's an example of... I think where the press has a real, what I think, positive impact and influence.
My name is Scott Mellis. I'm a senior political science major. You mentioned earlier that certain legislators may or may have not been qualified for their positions. What kind of qualifications do you believe a legislator should have?
Well, that's a good question, too. There's no set, resume, but the legislators I've seen over the years, you know, they usually come from professional backgrounds. You know, they've established themselves as, you know, attorneys, accountants, you know, real estate people, so they before they even run, you know, they've already had a career, and they've also been involved in the political process in their political party in various ways. So by the time they run for the legislature, and I'm talking about traditional, you know, the traditional way of it, you know, they're well known. They've established themselves in the community, and so they understand government. They understand the relationship between government and business, so that's, you know, that's what I consider qualified. In the Tea Party movement, you know, all people like that, it was an anti-incumbent movement. So people like that became the bad guys, you know, and it was like the people who would run around carrying signs saying, you know, don't take my guns or come and get my guns or, you know, or stuff like that. Suddenly they became viable players in the political process. Carl Wimmer, who was elected to the House, and then he ran for Congress, and he almost got through, you know, I mean, he came very close to being the Republican nominee for Congress, was an unemployed cop, you know, who had been fired from his job as a cop. That's what I'm talking about. He became a real popular figure for a while because he was a pretty good speaker, and he talked the talk. He had the rhetoric, you know. He had the anti-government, anti-incumbent rhetoric that became very popular for a while. But I think that a lot of people, you know, and it's the Republican Party where all this is playing out, and a lot of people in the Republican Party got alarmed at what they were seeing and started pushing back. And I think you're seeing now, again, the more responsible type people running and winning those spots.
Thank you. My name is Alit. I am a political student here at the University of Utah. I have a simple question. I was wondering, do you think that kind of a big change regarding the political landscape in your kind of experience as a political journalist? And what do you think, or do you see there will be the difference or a change regarding the political landscape in the future, let's say in 5 years from now?
Are you talking in Utah, or are you talking nationally?
In Utah.
Mm-hmm. I don't see any change in the political landscape as far. I mean, I've said this before. I don't believe I'll see a Democrat elected to a statewide office in my lifetime. We're just too entrenched as a Republican Party. Where there's a change, it's more of a subtle change, and that's going to be within the Republican Party. Because the Republican Party, I believe, is going to continue to dominate in Utah for a variety of reasons. But like I have said, I'm seeing a move back to a more moderate conservative. Utah is going to remain a very conservative Republican state. But I believe that there's a difference between conservative and Tea Party. And I'm seeing the conservatives now starting to win the argument again. The Tea Party movement was just a flash in the pan. And the Tea Party people that we now have in Congress are becoming an embarrassment to their own party, and their own party is recognizing that. So I see, I mean, the Republican Party, don't get me wrong, will continue to be a very conservative party, but a conservative party with substance and responsibility.
Hi, Rochelle Roberts again. I was curious, what has been your favorite story to work on? And then kind of a second question, do you think our national media is doing a good job covering politics and being honest with the people and, I guess, giving us good information?
I'm going to answer your second question first, because that was a really good question. No, I don't think the national media is doing a good job at all. In fact, I'm very concerned about the state of political journalism nationally right now. You know, you used to have, I think, you had the three networks, and they all had great, experienced, political reporters. And where we've come to now, because most people now watch cable TV, and where we've come to now, Fox News came along and developed this model, and it was, and I think, they spoke to a lot of conservative people who thought that the media wasn't, giving them, the whole story and that sort of thing. But Fox News became, basically a mouthpiece for the right-wing conservative movement under the guise of being a news organization. And then that became very popular, and it became a very popular model. And the same people who like to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day, and get that very narrow perspective, I would say inaccurate perspective on what's going on, they would be the same people who'd watch Fox News, and so that encouraged Fox News to continue that model and get embolden them to get more and more and more very, very partisan and very, right-wing in their rhetoric. Well, then MSNBC came along, and they saw the Fox News model on the right wing, so they did the same thing on the left wing. And they're just as biased. I mean, they're just as narrow and just as biased and as partisan on the left. And what has happened is, people, it's human nature, will tune into the newscast that agrees with their what they want to believe. And so, people who tend to want to be Republican will tune into Fox News, and they'll be reaffirmed of everything that Obama's evil and all this other stuff, and everything about the right wing is good, and everything else is bad, and then the people who want to be Democrats or kind of lean Democrats will tune into MSNBC and get the same rhetoric, the same on the left, and the same biased rhetoric. I did an experiment once, and I watched one of the two. When I talk about Fox and MSNBC, and then I taped the other, and I did that for a week in the evening, 5 days for a week, and then I wrote down everything that was covered on MSNBC, the stories that they thought were important, the rhetoric, the discussions, and everything else. And then the same thing for Fox News. And what I came up with was, if you were watching, if you watched Fox News that week and you watched MSNBC that week, and that's all you did that week, that's how you got your information, you would be living in two completely different universes. Your realities would be completely different, completely opposite from one another, because you got very, very narrow, biased coverage on both sides, and that's what's happened to the national media. And I think that's had a profound effect on the elections and on politics. And so, anyway, that's your first question. You asked me what my favorite story was that I ever covered. I like to tell this story because my favorite story that I ever covered, and this is goes back to an earlier question about the influence of the press. My favorite story that I ever covered was a story I never wrote, a column I never wrote, and I'll explain that. What happened was I had done a column. I'd found out about a case that it was a very disturbing case. It was a guy had gotten killed on driving up Parley's Canyon. It was in the middle of the winter, and the roads were really icy, and his car spun out of control. And then it flipped up onto the medium, and it skidded along the medium and ran into a bridge abutment, and he was killed. And his widow sued the state for negligence because of the way they had done the roads. And what came out was that they designed those mediums if you ran into it, they were designed in a curvature way to push you back onto the road. But they had repaved the highway so many times going up Parley's Canyon that it raised the road to the point where that curvature was had disappeared, and it negated that, you know, that advantage of pushing the car back on the road. And they even had studies where the state bureaucrats had known that they had created a dangerous situation and did nothing about it. So when that man's car hit the medium, it didn't do the job it was supposed to do because of they had raised the road so much, and they knew that that was a danger. So that was the case, and it went to trial, and she won, about a $300,000 judgment from a jury. And then the state appealed on government immunity, saying that you can't sue the government, even in a case of very blatant negligence like that. And then the appeals court ruled in favor of the state and said that government immunity protected the state, from that. And so they threw out the judgment. So then I got a call from that woman's attorney, and he told me that the attorney general's office, who had defended the state in the case, was going to go after, because now they prevailed, even though it was on a technicality, even though they'd actually lost at the jury level. But now they had prevailed, so they were going after attorney's fees. So they were going to try and recover about $40,000 in attorney's fees from this widow. And so I called up the attorney general. It was Jan Graham at the time. I called up her press person, and I said, I understand you're going after this widow for attorney's fees, now that you've won on a technicality. And so, she told Ms. Graham what I was going to do in the column, and I was going to write about this. So they got together, she and her top assistants, and they decided that they didn't want to have that kind of coverage where they were going after this widow who had actually, lost her husband because of the state's negligence for attorney's fees just because they went on a technicality. So they called her attorney back and said, we're not going to go after attorney's fees. And so then he called me and said, they've dropped that. They're not going to do that. So I didn't have a column anymore to write. But I had made a big difference to this woman. And so that's why I say that's my favorite story I've ever done that was never written.
Joel Johnson, political science major here at the U. I'm just wondering, I'm sure you've been following all this attorney general stuff. I'm wondering if you can give us any idea of where that's headed. Do you think it's going to end up in a UTA investigation? Are they going to have a grand jury?
Nobody knows where it's going to go at this point. Legally, there's still a question of whether John Swallow actually violated any laws. He certainly, his behavior and even his Republican colleagues have said this publicly, his behavior certainly stretches the boundaries of ethical behavior. What he's admitted to is he's admitted to meeting with a guy that was under investigation, felony fraud investigation by the feds for fraud and all those that sort of thing, and basically agreeing to line him up with somebody who can help him as a lobbyist for money. And he was the assistant, the chief deputy attorney general at the time. So the question is, should somebody in that position be meeting with somebody who's under investigation and then later, charged to help find a lobbyist for him and saying, oh, and by the way, you're going to need to pay my buddy so much money, to do this. And then John Swallow got, paid about $22,000. From the guy that he lined Jeremy Johnson up with, and he says it was for a different project, other than that one. It was for some cement project they were doing in Nevada, and he was doing government relations work for that. That raises another question: should somebody who's like a top official in the attorney general's office be going around, you know, doing all these side jobs, and getting paid, particularly from an industry. This was the payday loan industry. The guy owned a big bunch of payday loan stores. That is, you know, constantly under scrutiny and constantly under investigation for the way it does business, and a lot of people saying it stretches the, you know, the legal limits, you know, of what's – and that's been going on for years. But the Attorney General's office has been very close to that industry for a long time in terms of getting campaign contributions from them. Mark Shurtleff actually was flown to the Bahamas 1 year, you know, the former Attorney General who had hired John Swallow as his chief deputy, flown to the Bahamas 1 year to give a speech to the, you know, the national payday lending industry that was having some retreat back in the Bahamas, and the title of his speech was Is Greed Good? Whether he ends up getting charged, I don't know. I know that there is an investigation going on. I have found it interesting that his own Republican colleagues are sort of throwing him under the bus. You know, they're not. I did a column about the Utah County Lincoln Day Dinner, which is it's the annual. Each county has a Lincoln Day Dinner. It's their annual Republican Party fundraiser, and he went down to the Utah County Lincoln Day Dinner, and he had bought a table and sat at this table. Nobody would sit with him, and so he and his wife were sitting at this table all by themselves because nobody even wanted to have their picture taken with him. So he's suffering politically right now, but it's anybody's guess whether this will end up leading to charges. There are all sorts of factors that go in, and not the least, you know, I think probably some political factors go into it as well. But so we'll see where it goes. I think he's been very politically damaged, and I don't think anybody trusts him, and I don't think the Republican Party is, you know, wants to be too closely associated with him now either. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Matt Morissette. I'm a senior here at the U, and you seemed very adamant when you said that Utah will remain a conservative Republican state. Why do you think that is, and why can't Utah go the way of, say, Colorado, which is, you know, become a swing state and more liberal on the state level?
Back in the 1960s and 70s, Utah was a very split state, Democrat and Republican. The Democrats were very viable. I mean, there was a time in the 70s when back then we only had two congressmen. They were both Democrats, Wayne Owens and Gunn McKay. One of the two senators was Democrat, Ted Moss, who was defeated in 1976 by Orrin Hatch, who at the time said that Ted Moss had been in the Senate too long. He'd been there 18 years. Orrin Hatch has now been there 36 years. But anyway, so in the congressional delegation, the Democrats had three of the four. There was a time, a brief time in the 70s, when the Democrats held both houses of the legislature, narrow minority. What started the big shift in Utah, in my opinion, was Roe versus Wade. When that ruling came down, of course, the conservatives were very, very much opposed to that, to abortion. It became a Democratic issue. You know, they were in favor of it, you know, on civil rights issues and equal protection and that sort of thing. In Utah, it played a particular role, I think, in politically. It took a few years for it to really resonate, you know, like Utah became really Republican by the late 70s and then in 1980 with the Reagan Revolution. But, you know, the influence of the LDS Church here and its position on abortion had a lot to do with the changing landscape politically. where Republicans started, I mean, people started, or Mormons started seeing the Republican Party as really the place to go because of the moral issues like that and the social issues. And then Equal Rights Amendment debate, you know, became real strong in the late 70s. And the LDS Church actually came out opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. But that was, again, a big Democratic issue where the Democrats and became, on the National Women's Association or Organization of Women Now became very strong. But in states like Utah, they were seen as real radical and feminists and anti-tradition and that sort of thing. And the fact that the LDS Church had raised questions about the Equal Rights Amendment, again, pitted the LDS faithful or pushed them more toward the Republican camp, which was mostly opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. And then since then, the gay rights issue, the Democrats have been the party that's been very in favor of gay rights, and the Republican Party has been the one that has been very reluctant to, make these changes in their traditional value system. And the LDS Church, of course, for years took a very strong position, on traditional marriage and put a lot of money in different states in when there'd be referendums to outlaw, make sure gay marriage was outlawed and that sort of thing. The LDS Church itself is evolving on this issue, a lot of the people, the people who claim, that their politics is based on LDS values are slower to come along. So all those social issues, I believe have play a big part, and then there was something else that happened in the 70s. It seemed kind of innocuous at the time, but there was an interview with General Authority Ezra Taft Benson, who later became the president of the LDS Church. And I don't think he really meant this the way it eventually was interpreted, but he was a very, very, conservative Republican all his life, had been in the Eisenhower administration as Secretary of Agriculture. And he made the statement he didn't see how you could be a good, not understanding the gospel of the Mormon Church and a liberal Democrat at the same time. And that resonated a lot. I don't think that he meant that to happen. I think it was an innocent comment on his part. He was just, speaking his mind. But that had a big impact. And so for years and years, the Republican Party has been seen here locally as the party most aligned to LDS values. The Democrats have tried very hard to change that. They've run a lot of very prominent Mormons for public office, but they haven't been able to change that perception. And then in the legislature, like I said earlier, and every state, every party does this. In every state, the party that's in your professor's done a lot of research on this. He's an expert on this issue, on gerrymandering. But and the Democrats are just as bad. If the Democrats have the governor and the legislature, then they gerrymander the legislative and congressional boundaries to favor their party, and the Republicans have been very effective at doing that here in Utah. So I just don't see. The Democrats this last time around, I thought some very, very good candidates. Peter Cook was a very substantial candidate. And he got, 30-something percent of the vote. Because what happens, too, is generation after generation, you grow up in a Republican family, you're probably going to grow up to be a Republican. And you grow up in a Democratic family, you're probably going to grow up to be a Democrat. And it just seems to be getting further and further, you're more entrenched with each generation because kids will grow up and then they become voting age and they become like their parents. And it and it becomes, you know, in Utah we have big families. So, you know, a family with five kids, you know, starts out with two Republicans in the family, and the five kids grow up. Now there's seven Republicans in the family. And so that's why I said what I said. I just don't see a Democrat winning a statewide office here in Utah, and, you know, for a long, long time. Yes.
My name's Tyler Calder. I'm an econ major. Sorry. Going back to what you said about the national media, I was just wondering if you had any ideas or any thoughts on what could be done to remedy the situation that we do have.
Well, I don't know. Again, because of gerrymandering. I mean, you know, you've seen what's going on right now in Congress, and with this whole sequestration issue. And there being no compromise, you know, and both sides entrenched, and Congress is getting a lot of criticism for this. I mean, you know, their approval rating is down around, well, I don't know, 16-17% now, and so they're getting a lot of criticism. But the problem is the ones who are really entrenched, who won't budge, who won't move, and won't give John Boehner, you know, the votes he needs to get, you know, a majority to go into some kind of a compromise with the Democrats. They're all from gerrymandered districts, or most of them are from gerrymandered districts, which are really Republican, really conservative districts. So they're not worried about a challenge from a Democrat in the general election. What they're worried about is if they're not seen as being ideologically pure, they're going to get a challenge from somebody further on the right in their own Republican Party and could get bounced, which has happened to several incumbent Republicans within their own party. So they have to be as right-wing and as ideologically pure as they can for their own political survival rather than, you know, because they don't have to worry about the Democrats because of the way their districts are drawn.
Hello, my name is Faisal Marshad. I'm a political science student here. My question is, what do you think Utah legislatures should do to prevent a major impact on jobs and education here in Utah regarding the spending cuts?
Well, that's a very good question. Utah's economy is better than the nation as a whole and better than most states. We have a very impressive, good workforce here. There's a lot of concern that the continuing lack of funding for education is going to, have an impact on our workforce here and whether or not, companies want to come here and hire the local workforce. I think that education has done a really good job here given the what they've been handed to work with. Whatever happens nationally will impact Utah to the degree that it will, you know, impact, other states. Although I think that Utah could grow better than it is. And has been based on certain policy issues. One would be the alcohol policy here. They have a very limited number of liquor licenses they will give to restaurants. Anybody who has ever owned a restaurant or been in the restaurant business knows that to survive, you have to be able to serve liquor. There are some, you know, fast food places and stuff like that where that doesn't apply. But if you want to have a nice restaurant, you know, and you're competing against other restaurants that do serve liquor, you're not going to make it. And the legislature has been very reluctant to, you know, change that formula. There's always the argument that if you give more liquor licenses out, then you're going to encourage more drinking and drunk driving and teenage drinking and all that sort of thing. And then Utah's taken a lot of criticism from the industry, the restaurant industry, for this law that we have that you know, where you have, they call the Zion curtain, where you have these, you have to have barriers so the people in the restaurant don't see the bartender making the drink, which doesn't make a lot of sense to people, because then the bartender bring, or then the waitress brings the drink out, so you see the drink. But I mean, there are all these sorts of things because of their concern that, you know, they don't want to encourage, you know, the idea of alcoholic drinks. And so they put up all these barriers and all these roadblocks, but the effect is that then businesses don't want to come here and restaurants don't want to come here. And they've got a bill up there right now because there are a number of people. And again, you're seeing this loosen up a little bit because I believe of a more moderate group of Republicans that have replaced some of the more hardcore types before. But I mean, there's a bill up there now that would allow a chain, you know, say, you know, a national chain that wants to have several restaurants here. They can apply for one liquor license, and that will cover all their restaurants. And that's a way to loosen up more without actually increasing the number. Right now, the number of liquor licenses are based on a formula of population. And but where it's not realistic is they base it on our core population here, which is about, what, 2.7, 2.8 million. But they don't factor in the millions of visitors, tourists, that we get here every year. And so that's been an argument. So that's one bill that may have a chance of succeeding this year. But, you know, so they're trying to figure out a way to solve that problem that discourages businesses from coming here without making it look like they're increasing the accessibility to alcohol. So, I mean, I kind of got off on a little tangent on your question. But, I mean, those are some of the economic development things that are being discussed to help, you know, the job market and that sort of thing. As far as education goes, as I said earlier, there is a core Republican group that is pushing very hard for more investment in education and public education. And that's a battle going on within the Republican Party right now, where you've also got the people whose philosophy is we can do better with they're the people who favored vouchers for private schools, and we can do better in the private sector and that sort of thing. So that's the battle going on now.
So I think that wraps up time for us. Please, everyone, join me in thanking Mr. Raleigh for a great, informative forum.